Thanks very much, Hans, for that kind introduction. I hope with all the cameras my mother was watching. Returning to NDU is especially meaningful for me. I was a fellow here in the 1980s at an evocative time. Ronald Reagan was president. Nuclear conflict with the Soviet Union dominated defense scenarios, and the Berlin Wall appeared to forever separate two mutually antagonistic world systems. Yet even at the height of the Cold War, epoch-making forces were at work. We did not know it at the time, but the fall of communism was less than a decade away. Nor did we foresee the explosion and global spread of information technologies. The networks that became the internet were up and running the year I was here, but we had no idea they would change history. For all the capability information technology enables in our military and beyond, it also introduces new vulnerabilities. In 2008, a foreign intelligence agency penetrated our classified computer systems. Today, the cyber threat poses dangers to our security that far exceed what happened 3 years ago. My purpose today is to outline a strategy for confronting these threats, the department's first ever strategy for operating in cyberspace, which is what Hans showed you a moment ago. The cyber environment we face is dynamic. As such, our strategy must be dynamic as well. So while today is an important milestone, it is only one part of the department's efforts to learn and adjust through time. Addressing hostile cyber activities against our nation will necessarily involve many parts of our government. White House Cybersecurity Coordinator Howard Schmidt is here today, as our friends and colleagues from other agencies and departments. And from DOD, I want to particularly thank Principal Deputy Undersecretary for Policy Jim Miller, DOD CIO Terry Takai, Cyber Policy Lead Bob Butler, General Keith Alexander, who couldn't be with us today, and especially General Jim Cartwright, General Jim Haas Cartwright, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's given enormous leadership in all areas, and particularly cyber. And we're going to miss him after his retirement this summer. I also want to recognize Congressman Jim Langevin for his leadership in Congress on this important area. He's been at the forefront of this issue for several years, and he continues to lead and help the country from his perch in Congress. Thank you, Congressman. Keeping cyberspace secure will require the perspectives and capabilities of those with whom we share this space, especially private and commercial users. Many of those users have already been affected by criminal activity. And while identifying criminal activity in cyberspace is of concern, this is not the Defense Department's primary concern. Rather, our concern is specific to activities that threaten our mission to protect the security of the nation. We do not know the exact way in which cyber will figure in the execution of this mission or the precise scenarios that will arise. But the centrality of information technology to our military operations and our society virtually guarantees that future adversaries will target our dependence on it. Our assessment is that cyber attacks will be a significant component of any future conflict, whether it involves major nations, rogue states, or terrorist groups. Tools capable of disrupting or destroying critical networks, causing physical damage, or altering the performance of key systems exist today. The advent of these tools marks a strategic shift in the cyber threat, a threat that continues to evolve. As a result of this threat, keystrokes originating in one country can impact the other side of the globe in the blink of an eye. In the 21st century, bits and bytes can be as threatening as bullets and bombs. But disruptive and destructive attacks are only one end of a continuum of malicious activity in cyberspace that includes espionage, intellectual property theft, and fraud. Although in the future, we are likely to see destructive or disruptive cyber attacks that could have an impact analogous to physical hostilities, the vast majority of malicious cyber activity today does not cross that threshold. In looking at the current landscape of malicious activity, the most prevalent cyber threat to date has been exploitation, that is, the theft of information and intellectual property from government and commercial networks. This kind of cyber exploitation does not have the sudden payoff of a bank heist or the dramatic impact of a conventional military attack. But by blunting our edge in military technology and enabling competitors to copy the fruits of our commercial innovation, it has a deeply corrosive effect over the long term. It is hard to know how much damage this digital thievery does to our economic competitiveness and national security, but a recent estimate pegged cumulative economic losses at over $1 trillion. Today, sophisticated cyber capabilities reside almost exclusively in nation states. Here, U.S. military power offers a strong deterrent against overtly destructive attacks. Although attribution in cyberspace can be difficult, the risk of discovery and response for a major nation is still too great to risk launching destructive attacks against the United States. We must nevertheless guard against the possibility that circumstances could change, and we will have to defend against a sophisticated adversary who is not deterred from launching a cyber attack. Terrorist groups and rogue states must be considered separately. They have few or no assets to hold at risk and greater willingness to provoke. They are thus harder to deter. If a terrorist group gains disruptive or destructive cyber tools, we have to assume they will strike with little hesitation. And it is clear that terrorist groups, as well as rogue states, are intent on acquiring, refining, and expanding their cyber capabilities. So we stand at an important juncture in the development of the cyber threat. More destructive tools are being developed, but have not yet been widely used. And the most malicious actors have not yet obtained the most harmful capabilities. But this situation will not hold forever. There will eventually be a marriage of capability and intent, where those who mean us harm will gain the ability to launch damaging cyber attacks. We need to develop stronger defenses before this occurs. We have a window of opportunity of uncertain length in which to protect our networks against the most perilous threats. To prepare our military for emerging cyber threats, we have developed the DoD cyber strategy. This strategy holds that our posture in cyberspace must mirror the posture we assume to provide security for our nation overall. Namely, our first goal is to prevent war. We do this in part by preparing for it. And we do so while acknowledging and protecting the basic freedoms of our citizens. The steps we have taken to respond to the cyber threat has prompted, in recent weeks, discussion about cyber war and its implications. As we release the DoD cyber strategy, it's important to address this topic head on. Commentators have asked whether and how the U.S. would respond militarily to attacks on our networks. And this speculation has prompted concerns that cyberspace is at risk of being militarized, that a domain overwhelmingly used by civilians and for peaceful purposes could be fundamentally altered by the military's efforts to defend it. The concern here, as in other areas of our security, is that the measures put in place to prevent hostile actions will negate the very benefits of cyberspace we seek to protect. We have designed our cyberspace strategy to address this concern. It should come as no surprise that the United States is prepared to defend itself. It would be irresponsible and a failure of the Defense Department's mission to leave the nation vulnerable to a known threat. Just as our military organizes to defend against hostile acts from land, air, and sea, we must be prepared to respond to hostile acts in cyberspace. Accordingly, the United States reserves the right, under the laws of armed conflict, to respond to serious cyber attacks with a proportional and justified military response at the time and place of its choosing. Our ability to identify and respond to a serious cyber attack, however, is only part of the strategy. Our strategy's overriding emphasis is on denying the benefit of an attack. Rather than rely on the threat of retaliation alone to deter attacks in cyberspace, we aim to change our adversaries' incentives in a more fundamental way. If an attack will not have its intended effect, those who wish us harm will have less reason to target us through cyberspace in the first place. The logic behind denying the benefit of an attack, rather than relying exclusively on the threat of retaliation, flows from the nature of cyberspace itself. The Internet was designed to be open, transparent, and interoperable. Security and identity management were secondary objectives in system design. This lower emphasis on security in the Internet's initial design not only gives attackers a built-in advantage, it can also make intrusions difficult to attribute, especially in real time. This structural property of the current architecture of cyberspace means that we cannot rely on the threat of retaliation alone to deter potential adversaries. Some attackers might gamble that they could attack us and escape detection. An important element of our strategy is therefore focused on denying or at least minimizing the benefit of an attack. If we can minimize the impact of attacks on our operations and attribute them quickly and definitively, we may be able to change the decision calculus of an attacker. Enhancing our defenses also increases the resources needed to mount a successful attack, thereby making cyber attacks even less attractive to our adversaries. This emphasis on cyber defenses illustrates how we are both mindful of those who would do us harm using cyber means, but also committed to protecting the peaceful use of cyberspace. Far from militarizing cyberspace, our strategy of securing networks to deny the benefit of an attack will help dissuade military actors from using cyberspace for hostile purposes. Indeed, establishing robust cyber defenses no more militarizes cyberspace than having a Navy militarizes the oceans. This commitment to peace through preventative defense is at the heart of the DoD cyber strategy and the administration's overall approach to cyberspace. With this understanding, let me turn to the five primary pillars of our strategy. First, as a doctrinal matter, the Department is treating cyberspace as an operational domain like land, sea, air, and space. Treating cyberspace as a domain means that the military needs to operate and defend its networks and to organize, train, and equip its forces to perform cyber missions. Second, we are introducing new operating concepts on our networks, including active cyber defenses. These active defenses use sensors, software, and signatures to detect and stop malicious code before it affects our operations, thereby denying the benefit of an attack. The third and fourth pillars of our strategy recognize the interconnectedness of cyberspace and the diversity of uses to which it is put by individuals, in our economies, and across nations. Because cyberspace is composed of many interwoven networks, that perform many different functions, ensuring its peaceful use will require efforts on many fronts. The men and women of the military, other government agencies, our allies, the private sector, and indeed the citizens of cyberspace all must play a role. The third pillar specifically recognizes that a number of non-military networks support important military functions. This is especially true when it comes to the power grid, the transportation system, and the financial sector. So to protect our military capability, we must work with the Department of Homeland Security and the private sector to protect the nation's critical infrastructure. Our fourth pillar carries the logic of interconnectedness to our allies and international partners. Our goal with them is to build collective cyber defenses. Collective cyber defenses will help expand our awareness of malicious activity and the speed with which we can defend against ongoing attacks. Fifth, our strategy aims to fundamentally shift the technological landscape of cybersecurity. Simply put, we want to enhance network security to reduce the advantages the attacker presently enjoys relative to the defender on the internet. Leveraging the nation's technological and human resources to increase the security of network technology is not only in our best interest, a more secure and resilient internet is in everyone's interest. Over the past year, we have made progress in each of these five pillars. To centralize the operation and defense of our networks, we stood up U.S. Cyber Command and made it fully operational. We have established supporting activities in each of the military services, and we are now training our forces to thwart attacks that might compromise our operations. Although no network will ever be perfectly secure, our military networks today are better defended and our cyber hygiene more effective than before. On the international front, we have partnered with Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and NATO. And under the President's international strategy, we will seek greater cooperation with more nations in the coming months. We've also committed $500 million in R&D funds to accelerate research on advanced defensive technologies. Our research agenda includes novel approaches to improving network security and defenses. We imagine a time when computers innately and automatically adapt to new threats. We hope for a world when we can not only transmit information in encrypted form, but also keep data encrypted as we perform regular computer operations. Having data 100% encrypted would be a revolution in computer security, greatly enhancing our ability to operate in untrusted environments. Lastly, we've made substantial progress in working with private industry and the rest of government to make our critical infrastructure more secure. I'd like to spend the final part of my remarks discussing this crucial area and its importance to national security. To date, malicious cyber activity has been directed at nearly every sector of our infrastructure and economy. The IMF, Citibank, Sony's PlayStation Network, the secure token provider RSA, Google, NASDAQ, and multiple energy firms have all been targeted. Cyber intruders have been so effective that even companies employing sophisticated commercial defenses have fallen victim. In fact, our venue here today, the National Defense University, has been struck. The NDU website and its associated server were recently compromised by an intrusion that turned over system control to an unknown intruder. The country's critical infrastructure has also been probed. Because much of this critical infrastructure supports military operations, its failure could compromise our abilities to protect the nation. Our military bases and installations are part of, and not separate from, the critical infrastructure on which all Americans depend. 99% of the electricity the U.S. military uses comes from civilian sources. 90% of U.S. military voice and internet communications travel over the same private networks that service homes and offices. We also rely on the transportation system to move military personnel and freight, on commercial refineries to provide fuel, and on the financial industry to process our payments. Significant disruptions to any one of these sectors could impact defense operations. A cyber attack against more than one could be devastating. The integrity of the networks that undergird critical infrastructure must therefore be considered as we assess our ability to carry out national security missions. In the United States, the Department of Homeland Security has responsibility for protecting critical infrastructure. In the past year, we have signed a memorandum of agreement with DHS to seamlessly coordinate our cybersecurity efforts. We have established a joint planning capability, an exchange of personnel in our cyber operations centers, and we are helping Homeland Security deploy advanced defensive technologies on our government networks. The critical infrastructure the military depends upon also extends to the private companies that build the equipment and technology we use. Their networks hold valuable information about our weapon systems and their capabilities. The theft of design data and engineering information from within these networks undermines the technological edge we hold over potential adversaries. It is therefore a significant concern that over the past decade, terabytes of data have been extracted by foreign intruders from corporate networks of defense companies. Indeed, in a single intrusion this past March, 24,000 files were taken. When looking across the intrusions of the past few years, some of the stolen data is mundane: specifications for small parts of tanks, airplanes, and submarines. But a great deal of it concerns our most sensitive systems, including aircraft avionics, surveillance technologies, satellite communication systems, and network security protocols. The cyber exploitation being perpetrated against defense industry cuts across a wide swath of crucial military hardware, extending from missile tracking systems and satellite navigation devices to UAVs and the Joint Strike Fighter. Current countermeasures have not stopped this outflow of sensitive information. We need to do more to guard our digital storehouse of design innovation. Toward that end, the Department of Defense, in partnership with DHS, has established a pilot program with a handful of companies. This program provides these defense companies with more robust protection for their networks. In this Defense Industrial Base, or DIB cyber pilot, classified threat intelligence is shared with defense contractors or their commercial internet service providers, along with the know-how to employ it in network defense. By furnishing this threat intelligence, we're able to help strengthen these companies' existing cyber defenses. In this way, the DIB cyber pilot builds off existing capabilities that are widely deployed through the commercial sector. By leveraging infrastructure that already exists, the pilot suggests that we can provide substantial additional protections across our critical infrastructure for only a fractional increase in cost. In the DIB cyber pilot, the U.S. government is not monitoring, intercepting, or storing any private sector communications. Rather, threat intelligence provided by the government is helping the companies themselves or the internet service providers working on their behalf to identify and stop malicious activities within their networks. Although we are only beginning to evaluate the effectiveness of the pilot, it has already stopped intrusions for some participating industry partners. And although the information sharing the pilot promotes, we not only halt intrusions, we also learn from the diversity of techniques used to perpetrate them. The DIB cyber pilot breaks new ground in recognizing the interconnectedness of cyber and the important role of stakeholders in thwarting attacks. We have much to do to protect our critical infrastructure from sophisticated intrusions and attacks. But by establishing a lawful and effective framework for the government to help operators of critical infrastructure defend their networks, we hope the DIB cyber pilot can measurably enhance the security of our nation's critical infrastructure. We are a long way from the world I knew while a fellow at NDU. Superpower competition has faded, yielding a strategic environment that is unlike anything that we could have imagined. Whereas the Berlin Wall once divided us, now we are more interconnected than ever. Our responsibility is to acknowledge this new environment and adapt our security instruments to it. That is the purpose of the DoD cyber strategy. We must prepare. We must recognize the interconnectedness of cyber, and we must be mindful of the many ways cyberspace is used as a peaceful instrument of global communications, as a tool for economic growth, but also as an instrument to threaten and sometimes cause harm. Given this broad landscape of activity in cyberspace, we must both protect its peaceful shared uses as well as prepare for hostile cyber acts that threaten our national security. The strategy we are announcing today helps establish that balance. It provides a framework for us to promote our nation's values in this vital civilian space while carrying out our duty to protect the nation. Thank you. At this point, we have a few minutes for questions. I'd like General Hoss Cartwright to join me to answer the hard ones.
Sure. Dan Keel, faculty of the iCollege here at NDU. You've used repeatedly a word that I stress with my students as the most important word in our course, interconnectedness. But you're focused on the defensive or the protective side of that. How are we as the DoD using that interconnectedness to deliver content to influence friends and influence adversaries all over the world?
Well, I mean, the thrust of this strategy is a defensive strategy in terms of protecting the networks on which we rely for our military capabilities. But as I indicated, and as you stressed, the interconnectedness of the internet makes it an extraordinarily valuable tool for getting our message out, both internally. We've allowed social media to be used with our troops and their families to enormous benefit, as well as externally, is get our message out vis-a-vis our adversaries. And that's certainly an important thrust. It's not quite in this strategy, but it's certainly a part of the overall landscape. Ross, did you want to?
My sense is that, you know, there are kind of three elements to the system here. There's an element of command and control so that you know what you're doing. There's an element of sensors so that you can tell what's being done on the networks, and that gives you the information. And then there are tools. Some of those tools are kinetic, some of them non-kinetic, some are offensive, some are defensive. The question of how you use them and the balance you use them depends on the adversary. But what we're trying to do in this framework is establish the command and control side of this activity, then the sensor side of this activity, to start to build a layering in depth for defense initially and situation awareness. That can then be carried out to use tools, particularly for interconnectivity, social media, influence. Those types of activities are the early manifestations of a tool set.
Sam Lyles from the iCollege here at NDU. Gentlemen, I read through the document, and it looks like there are three primary threat actors you're looking at. One would be the nation state, one would be the insider threat, and the third would probably be classified as something like an insurgency. Yet the command structure that's shown is very, very much a top-down, hierarchical kind of command structure. Do you see that there's going to be any issues in implementation when you're going up against highly networked adversaries that are less than hierarchical?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that you should take away from the strategy is it has to be multi-layered. that indeed everybody is on the front line. So the first element of any, I think, cyber defense strategy is good hygiene. You need people to download the patch. You need to keep antivirus suites current. And then it works up from there. You need perimeter defenses, firewalls, and you need active defenses. You need to be able to hunt on your own network. You need to be able to act against threats when you find them. So we're at very, some of it's hierarchical, other parts are distributed. I think you need to combine all of that to deal with the various elements of the threats that you laid out.
I think that's the premise. The question that we have, first, we've done it in a very structured way so that we can represent how to raise force, how the services train it, educate it, and then present it to combatant commanders to be used in the defensive way or offensive ways as is appropriate. So that structure is important to be structured so that you know exactly how things are going to operate. We are just now at the cutting edge and at the forefront here really of understanding how these networks are going to be used and what are the best ways to organize ourselves to do that. So the representation of a command is one element of the activity. The representation of how we organize to actually work in this environment is work that Cyber Command's doing right now to try to understand what's effective. Do we take small teams, put them out? How much is dislocated? How much is centralized? Those activities are activities that we're learning. That's part of what our schools are out doing. That's part of what we look to NDU to be able to do, is to start to help us. When we look at the activities that have gone on, say, for the Arab Spring activity out there, what are the implications of the social media activity? When does it work? When doesn't it work? How can you intervene if you want to? How can you participate if you want to? Those activities, we're just starting to learn. This is really a new frontier.
Question over here.
Hi, Ryan Wagner, Institute for Defense Analyses. Does DoD reserve the right to respond to foreign cyber attacks on domestic non-military related cyber infrastructure?
Well, it's the United States, not DOD, first. Second, I think the response is dictated by the effect, not by the location. If there's massive damage, massive human losses, significant economic damage, it would be in those circumstances that I think the president would consider all of the tools that he has, economic, diplomatic, and as a last resort, military.
Might just jump in. If it's an attack on the United States, there are two general authorities that we can invoke by the president: defense support to civil authorities, and then the Insurrection Act. Both of those are available. DHS has the primary responsibility for defending inside the United States along with justice. We would be called in as appropriate based on the judgment of the type of attack, as the Secretary said.
Thank you. Professor Duke here, faculty at the Information Resource Management College. One of the questions is that more and more we come out with new technologies, and the younger groups like to jump on these conveniences of these technologies. And yet now we're looking at some of these technologies that cause or could cause damage to our critical infrastructure, as you were talking about, i.e. GPS. We all like the convenience of having it now in our cars, but now we know it to be able to take down aircraft, stop ships out in the harbors. What's being done to look at how we can slow down the conveniences without trading off security throughout the community?
Well, I don't know that we're looking to slow down conveniences, but the thrust of that fifth pillar that I mentioned in the strategy is to look at the balance between offense and defense, between attacker and defender on the internet. As the internet was developed, the emphasis was on expansion and introduction of technology and on transparency. And so the security is lower, but I think it's possible to introduce technologies that enhance the security of the internet, that enhance identity management, encryption of data at rest, I mentioned. You can do those things in a way that doesn't compromise the civilian and commercial benefits of the internet, but improves the security of the network and ultimately rebalances in a better way between attacker and defender.
Luis Kuhn, Professor of National Security at the Centers for Hemispheric Defense Studies. From the critical infrastructure protection, you mentioned financial, electric, grid, and transportation. From my perspective, all 18 infrastructure are interrelated. And the water, not just for the warfighter, but for every American citizen, the food, actually global health. We live in a global economy, so imports, every single infrastructure touches that cyberspace. And therefore, do you have a part two?
I think there are kind of two parts to that. One is the Department of Homeland Security is the lead government agency for the protection of commercial networks or interacting with the civilian sector for protection of those critical infrastructure networks. One of their goals, I think, is to help identify where are the boundaries of critical infrastructure, what does need to be protected. The role of the Department of Defense is a supporting role. We have capabilities that can be brought to the table. We have resources that we're in the role. This is similar to disaster relief, where DOD has enormous resources that can be brought to bear to aid hurricane victims and others, but the lead agency is FEMA. And it's that same kind of relationship that we're trying to build here in terms of protecting critical infrastructure. Did you want to jump?
Just, this goes back to the first question of how interconnected everything is. And trying to understand how to build a layered defense and to build that layering in such a way that your most critical activities are the most protected on out. And everybody's okay with that as long as they're the most protected. And what we've got to understand here are the interconnectivity implications so that an attack on one infrastructure that could not cascade down to another. Things like smart grid and whatnot are designed to start to help us do that.
Over here.
Chuck Berry, Institute for National Strategic Studies. Since we're talking about DOD, I wonder if you could comment on the laws of war, how those might apply in cyberspace. I'm particularly thinking of the fact Luis mentioned healthcare. Some of the hospitals are now have databases that are critical to operations. What I mean by operations there is medical operations. And how do those get the Red Cross on them in cyberspace like you have on top of an ambulance or a hospital?
Well, applying international law in cyberspace, I think, is one of the great challenges. Indeed, I think what you're seeing as a general matter is the technology has far outpaced the legal and policy frameworks that we have, and that we're really trying to play catch up, not only just legal, but in policy. And the international law side of that is part of that. So we need to understand how do these concepts apply, when do we need concepts. And it's difficult because there's no real sovereignty in the internet. It crosses borders. The effects of actions in the internet can take place in a matter of microseconds. So there's no time to have a deputies committee meeting and decide how to react. So this is an extremely difficult area where I think we need a great deal more work.
Hi, I'm Mark Fedak with Salient Federal Solutions, one of your DOD contractors. I liked hearing a lot about your DIB cyber program or pilot and how successful that's been. I think that's great news. What I'd like to know is when can this be expanded to the hundreds of other DIB members that are under attack?
Well, we're in the pilot involves less than two dozen companies, and it's just that. It's pilots can take about 90 days. We'll be finished at the end of the summer. We're going to assess where we are. And then once with that assessment, we'll be looking at both Can you expand it vertically, that is, add more of the defense industrial base sector? And can you expand it horizontally, that is, can we expand it to other critical infrastructure sectors, and is it appropriate to do so? So we're going to be looking in the fall at exactly that those decisions.
You know, my sense also is relative to the last question is that after we get through this pilot, rather than arguing about these issues of law in an abstract form of what if, could you, we'll have now hard data, hard questions. How did this work? What were the implications and privacy in the intellectual capital of a company? How do you protect that, and are we doing it the right way? So it will also allow us to leverage that activity and real action to be able to understand some of these issues that are emerging in law.
David King, the Industrial College. I have a rather more pedestrian question. This is like insurance. We tend to underinsure. Who's paying? You have mentioned some money. Will the federal government pay? Will DOD pay? Who buys Fairfax County's water security infrastructure? And who encourages private sector firms to spend ahead of an identified risk?
Well, as I said, the I should have probably add the legal and policy framework as well as the business model here, I think, are challenges. It's clear who pays for the security of military networks. It's DOD with funding from the U.S. taxpayers. For critical infrastructure, it's a harder call. And one of the reasons this is a short pilot is for 90 days, people are willing to hold their breath and not worry about the who pays part. But when we go beyond that, if we get more permanent, there is a question of who pays. And that's one of the central questions we're tackling in this assessment. What is the business model? Is this something, you know, what role does the government have? What role does do the internet service providers have? What role, what is their business model? Who are the users? Is there how do they pay? Should they pay? All that needs to be addressed if we're going to make this a workable proposition.
Thank you. I'm Helen Warman with the Brookings Institution. While we're all playing catch up to get technology and legal things in place, is there anything going on in parallel with the DOD's activities with our allies and partners to sort of rethink some about how the internet works and perhaps how to regulate it so that people who are willing to take responsibility can have more influence over how it operates?
Let me say something and ask Haas to join. First, we have Howard Schmidt, our White House cyber coordinator, and Chris Painter, the lead cyber person at State. They have been traveling the world talking with our international partners about exactly that question. And with our allies, I think we're further along. We have an MOU with the UK and Australia for cyber cooperation. NATO's identified it as a central priority and is putting more resources into it. We're also looking at the international forums as to what our engagement strategy should be there. I think we want to promote a world in which we have greater network security, and we're looking at the what are the international venues for doing just that. Yes, Costa.
My sense is that one of the things that we often do wrong when confronted with a problem in cyberspace is that we say, first, let's fix ourselves. And the problem is the network is global. It really doesn't pay a lot of attention. And so we can easily fix ourselves and hurt someone else, or someone else trying to fix themselves. And so getting these dialogues going is critical. We are at the dialogue level still, but we are starting to move out so that we understand that an attack on us may well be an attack on many of our neighbors, that attack and how it's manifested and how it's interpreted tends to translate to the action you take, the remediation activities. We can easily compromise each other if we don't talk on the remediation. So starting to get the venues by which these conversations can occur in an authoritative way is part of the work that is being done right now. That's the early stages. The more regulated activities as we go to the future that ensure layered defenses for all, awareness for all, is part of what has to happen too.
I should have mentioned also the White House put out our international cyberspace strategy about 6 weeks ago, and that lays out a path on that, so you should you take a look at that as well. I think we have time for one more question. Right here.
From this discussion, it is apparent that one of the big problems of in this whole cyber defense strategy is we are not able to attribute. So non-attribution is the biggest problem. And as you know, in academia and research institutes, there are new protocols being developed which try to answer that question. So in this cyber strategy, do you have any option that it should be encouraged from DoD point of view? And if it is mature enough, then we should go full-fledged to that new internet.
Well, two things there, I think. I mean, one, you're certainly correct. Attribution is a huge challenge in the internet, and certainly from a defense perspective, a missile attack comes with a return address. A cyber attack does not. It's very difficult to attribute cyber attacks. That said, we are getting much better at it, but it's still a laborious process to do that forensic work. So the thrust of this strategy at this point is to take that into account, and it's part of the basis on which we're looking at a denial of benefit strategy as a significant emphasis in that is because of the challenge of attribution. Thank you very much.